The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, your home for NPR News for the past 32 years. And this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. We begin today's show with a story we've been covering for some time. 12 years ago, Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District, comprised of Baxter, Marion, Searcy, Boone, Newton, and Carroll counties, borrowed money to purchase an old landfill. The district's goal was to centralize waste management operations and make money on outside waste hauler contracts. That venture failed, and last April, a circuit court decided that property owners will be assessed millions of dollars over time to cover the debt and landfill closure fees. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich explains.
12 years ago, Northwest Arkansas Regional Solid Waste Management District, later renamed Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District, purchased a 20-year-old, 700-acre working landfill in rural Baxter County and waste hauling business. Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District, based in Harrison, brokered the deal, helping to secure more than $12 million in revenue bonds and loans. But state and independent environmental inspections later revealed a lot more money would be needed. Berryville Mayor Tim McKinney is former chair and current member of the Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District Board.
I think we had faith that the Economic Development District would get all this straightened out, and it didn't happen. They submitted two or three different plans to ADEQ to take care of it. They were all rejected by ADEQ.
There was talk of hiring a professional waste management firm to take over operations, clean up an expansion of the landfill, which McKinney says he supported, but the board in the end failed to reach consensus.
My personal opinion is, you know, going back and everybody's got 20/20 hindsight, but I think it was headed for bankruptcy from the day it was purchased because of mismanagement. Because they paid too much.
The landfill charged higher tipping fees to cover costs. It began to lose customers. Even district members hauled their trash elsewhere. In early 2014, the Solid Waste District filed for bankruptcy. The Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality was directed by the state legislature to use state landfill post-closure trust fund money to clean up and seal the landfill. 2 months later, the Solid Waste District's chief creditor filed an injunction to block the bankruptcy declaration. 5 months after that, a Western District bankruptcy court judge in Harrison ruled the Waste District was not eligible to file bankruptcy. In his decision, Judge Ben Berry also wrote that the district acted in bad faith by not assessing higher fees to support landfill operations and cleanup. The landfill is now under receivership. Last April, Pulaski County Circuit Court Judge Tim Fox approved the receiver's recommendations to assess every property owner in the Solid Waste District an annual fee until the debt is paid off. Carroll County Quorum Court Justice of the Peace Lamont Ritchie says he's angry about how things turned out.
Next spring, when the tax bills come in and people find $18 put onto their tax bill, and that they're going to find this on their tax bill for probably the next three decades.
Property owners in the six-county solid waste district are now responsible for more than $25 million of debt, including $12 million startup costs, reimbursement of the $12 million trust fund cleanup by ADEQ, and other expenses. Once the debt is paid off, district property owners will be assessed another $2 post-closure fee for perpetuity annually. Ritchie says the district had the opportunity to assess higher service fees on property owners, but never took it. He points to testimony made by Berryville Mayor Tim McKinney last summer before the bankruptcy court.
That the actual reason why they didn't impose a service fee years ago is because members on the board were afraid how it was going to impact their reelection chances. So it was a political decision.
We asked Mayor Tim McKinney to elaborate about his statement on the record, but he declined. He lays blame squarely on the Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District, which originally brokered the deal.
The bottom line for the board is they put too much trust in the Economic Development District that they were handling this purchase and management of the landfill in a professional way, and now that if you go back and look at the records, it's very clear they were not. And it just made a bad business decision that much worse.
The Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District administrator in charge of the landfill project has long been retired, but in a previous interview with Ozarks at Large on this issue, he blames the Solid Waste District for not hiring an expert waste management firm to repair and expand the landfill into what he described as a plum of a money-making venture. To gain a better understanding around all the circumstances leading to the failure of the landfill and consequential receivership, Arkansas Pollution Control and Ecology Commissioner Wesley Stites, at a recent agency meeting, asked ADEQ Director Becky Keough to provide a written report. On October 16th, the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality is hosting a media tour of the defunct landfill outside of Mountain Home to show just how trust fund cleanup is progressing. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The devastation in Puerto Rico has inspired a Bentonville businessman to become a relief effort organizer. Patrick Byrd, CEO of 1912 Walton, and his wife and co-workers have organized a series of fundraisers to help their fellow Americans on the Caribbean island recover from the damage caused by Hurricane Maria. Earlier this week, he came to Studio 123 to talk with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about the new organization, NWA Puerto Rico Relief.
My wife and I went down to Puerto Rico a few years ago, and we just fell in love with the country, and not so much, you know, we traveled quite a bit, and we fell in love with the people. They were so nice. Everywhere we stayed in Fajardo, but we went to Ponce, we went all over the place, and even people at the airport were so nice. The TSA people were nice. Everybody, the most beautiful thing were the people. Everywhere we went, everyone was really nice. So I'm from Fort Smith, and one of my good friends lives in Puerto Rico now with his twin brother. And he, with all these hurricanes coming through, I'd text him before this hurricane came through. It was like, hey, are you okay? That he would leave the island and stuff. And I have some other friends that were Puerto Rican as well, and they said, well, we don't really, we get Puerto Ricos, but it never really hits, we kind of just watch them, kind of like, we don't really worry that much about tornadoes until, like, Joplin happens. We just, accept them. People from California say, oh, well, there's a bunch of, aren't you worried about tornadoes? And you go out to California, you're worried about earthquakes. And Puerto Rico, you're worried about hurricanes. Well, so this one, they actually left the island, came back to the island, and then they waited out, and they thought it was going to be massive. So his twin brother got on a plane with his wife and his kids and left, and he stayed back. He's not married, doesn't have any kids. And he came in there, and I was at the Razorback Texas A&M game, and he didn't have any telecommunications to get worried about him. And a text came through during second quarter. It said, I'm okay. It's really bad. And I texted him back, and I said, do I need to get you a plane and get you out of there? And he said, no. I need to stay. There's too much to do. He's a former, Eagle Scout, just a really great guy. Been very successful in business, but he said, there's too much to do. And then I text back, what can I do? And he had very limited, reception. So he just texts back. He said, just help. And he said, get a hold of my brother. But he said, just help. That's all he put down. And then I didn't talk to him again for a while. I contacted his brother and said, what are some things that we can do? He said, what are needs? And he kind of told me, he goes, it's worse than anything you can imagine, and sent me some pictures and said, the island is devastated. There's no electricity. There's no running water. There's no anything. It's just gone. I mean, just everything got demolished. And as the report started coming in with all the other Hurricane Harvey and all the other, places that hit people were kind of, it was kind of the third tier. So the first thing I thought is, they're not reporting on it on the news. and we need to bring eyes to it. And, you know, one of the issues is, you know, they're American citizens, and just like Arkansas is not even 3 million people, there's 3.4 million. If you can imagine a state not having power, people at nursing homes where, you know, elderly people are going to literally die. They have some generators and stuff, but they don't have the diesel to fill them. Then the people are going to get hot. It's the Caribbean. And, you know, so, one of the things we set up is, like, what do you really need? They're like, we need clean water. He actually said we need generators. We need food. And so all we knew to do was to a group of us, my wife and I, we said, well, let's just help. What can we do? So
it's basically the people at your company that are helping out, right?
Yes. It includes, it's our people from our company. And then I reached out to one of my Puerto Rican friends. Her name is Irelia Navarro. And she kind of helped me early on. I asked her some questions because her family still lives there. Irelia helped put together some of the needs with some local community. There's other people trying to coordinate relief efforts. So we've had people reach out to us from other relief efforts, you know, from churches to salons or wherever it might be, and saying, like, hey, we want to take some donations. And so we're really just kind of the gatherers. And so we gather the products, then we give them. Our end goal is we have a truck or trucks, and we'll take the donations and take them to Tampa, Florida, where they'll consolidate them for the Salvation Army for Puerto Rico, and then they'll ship them on containers. The issue is kind of logistics right now is actually receiving goods over there, so a lot of it has to be done by planes. But so ours will come in, consolidate out, and they have the truck is going to be leaving November 1st or 2nd, so we're going to be shipping down kind of that October 27th. So a lot of these events are coming up to this, or for the donation-wise, we'll wrap up, but we'll still kind of get together in any kind of financial donations. We'll do, and if there's a need and the community keeps giving, we'll take a secondary truck. But all the donations now will actually go for that November ship that will be going down to Puerto Rico to help the people. So everything we give now will be a quick response to what the need is.
And so what specifically are you looking for in terms of donations? I know a lot of times when there are disasters like this, there's kind of a debate between, okay, well, do I give cash or do I give, you know, toiletries? What's better? And you're collecting physical items.
Right. So we're doing both. So we're going to raise cash through our events. And we're also going to, the donation wise, is they don't need coats and stuff. You know, it is the Caribbean. What they've specifically asked for is water, canned foods, mosquito spray, toiletries, anything from, can be deodorant sticks to diapers, things that, you know, necessity items that they're going to need. If you can imagine not being able to get to store, it's very hard. Some of the areas are very remote. The roads have been washed out. So all that stuff kind of gets brought to a holding period, and that people come in from the villages and the communities come in, get their stuff and go back. But it's not easy. So they take as much as they can. So, that's kind of what it is. So a lot of the retailers have been shut down, and, you know, they're working on the retailers are working on diesel and generators to stay open to give the people an opportunity to get products.
Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the events that you'll be hosting? You've got a couple lined up as of right now.
Yes. So our first event is at Krabby's. It's October 11th from 6 to 9. We have Krabby's is going to donate a portion of all the sales on everything they sell to the relief effort, and they're going to have a band. Randall Shreve is a very popular musician that's going to be playing live on the patio, and so it'll be a great time. We'll have a truck there where we'll be able to take donations, and plus all the cash that'll be generated there will be donated. And then October 12th, we have a bingo night at Millwood Christian Church. It's right off the Pleasant Grove exit, and all that money that's raised will go to the relief effort. And we have 50-50 tickets where we'll sell tickets for $5 at all the events, and then we'll be able to give those away at the bingo events. We'll be able to raise money, and then we have another game on October 26th where the prize will be given away. So collectively, if we sell 2,000 tickets, which would be $10,000, the person will get $5,000, and then our charity will get $5,000 to be able to donate. So we're pretty excited about that. The next event is October 18th at Gasano's. We'll have a silent auction, and we'll also have get together with pizza, and they're going to give away a portion of their proceeds again to the relief effort. And, you know, a lot of people have come along the silent auction, so if you have something you want to donate, we're going to have baskets, so we'll put that on a list, and you can find it on Facebook pages. You just get on there and say companies like Nickelodeon to Lentz & Company, just down the line, all these great companies are giving out samples if you're in the supplier community, to if you work at a salon, to hairspray, or we have wedding photographers donating their time. And so all those will be auctioned off, and then it goes to a great cause, and we'll raise all that money. And then so if you want to be a part of that, look on our Facebook page. But that's October 18th. Then our main drop-off point is at Beauterre Office Park, and that is available anytime through October 18th. You just bring in your goods. We have a door that says Puerto Rico Relief on the outside, and you just come in and drop off. It's already earmarked on the pallets. It says water, food, whatever, and you just insert here. So we got a lot of great events, and then we're going to have one as of now, we got one donation event on Saturday, October 14th at the Pinnacle Neighborhood Market. We'll have we'll be set out outside, so you go in and come see us. And we're going to be taking donations from 10 to 1. And like I said, we're so thankful. We've had such support. My wife and I are very excited, and it really shows how much people of Arkansas care, you know, about everybody in general. I can't tell you how many people have reached out and, you know, just believe in helping. And so we live in a great state for that.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Patrick Byrd with NWA Puerto Rico Relief, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Details about upcoming fundraisers are available at the NWA Puerto Rico Relief Facebook page. And Antoinette will be back on today's show in just a few minutes, speaking with some of the principals behind a new mentoring program for LGBTQ students on the University of Arkansas campus. That's just ahead.
The Federal Reserve's second-in-command is resigning this month, and before he goes, he offers advice to the person who will take over his job.
Don't throw your weight around until you know in which direction to throw it. It takes a while to get to understand how an organization runs.
I'm Robert Siegel, Vice Chair of the Federal Reserve, Stanley Fisher, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3. Special collections at the University of Arkansas Libraries will mark American Archives Month with an open house tomorrow. Included, bingo and scavenger hunt related events. Joshua Cobbs Youngblood with Special Collections says the ultimate throwback Thursday begins in Special Collections on the first floor of Mullins Library tomorrow at 2:30.
You come down and you'll get to see some stuff that we've selected, some really great rare books acquisitions, some recent archives, some things that each of the specialists has chosen as their favorite things to show you. And then a few days later, also in Archives Month, you can get to see this really important manuscript that we've brought in on the 18th.
What's your staff selection for that day on the 12th?
It's a great question.
Have you not made it yet?
Yes, I have a couple of them. And so actually what I'm falling down on is like my focus is a selection from the John Gold Fletcher papers.
Yes.
Pulitzer Prize winning poet, originally from Little Rock. He was also a world traveler. Good friends with people like T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, other, you know, writers that people might have heard of. So we have his archives. But so my selection is actually much closer tied to Arkansas. So I'm going to have a couple of books from his rare books collection, which we have, written by a guy named Kenneth Yasuda, who was a Japanese translator. He also was a Japanese American who was interned at Jerome here in the state of Arkansas, who developed a friendship with Fletcher. And so I'm going to have the books that he sent Fletcher, he inscribed to him, to say, you know, thank you for your support. Then I'll also have some correspondence from their relationship. And then some actual records from Jerome, which we also have in our archives, that document his being there as well as some other internees.
Joshua Cobbs Youngblood with University of Arkansas Special Collections. Tomorrow's celebration of American Archives Month begins on the first floor of Mullins Library on the U of A campus at 2:30.
91.3 KUAF is supported by Ozark Natural Foods, Northwest Arkansas's consumer-owned food co-op since 1971. offering all natural groceries, organic produce, health and wellness products, and more. Ozark Natural Foods, located in the Evelyn Hill Shopping Center, or on the web at onf.coop. Additional support provided by Working Class Physical Therapy, a source for manual therapy, plus education concerning posture, body mechanics, and general stress reduction. Therapies for neurological conditions, including Parkinson's and stroke, also available. 466-6910 or email therapydawn@aol.com. The second annual AMP Fest is Saturday, October 14th at the Walmart AMP in Rogers. This beer, music, and tech festival will feature live music from John Paul White of the Civil Wars, plus David Shaw and Zach Feinberg from the Revivalists, Adam Fawcett, and many others. Proceeds benefit Walton Arts Center programs and education. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
This is Ozarks at Large. Today is National Coming Out Day, a time to celebrate coming out as LGBTQ or as an ally, as well as mark the anniversary of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. On the University of Arkansas campus, faculty and staff have been working to make LGBTQ students feel safer and included not just today, but every day. The latest effort includes the launch of a mentoring program. The new project was the brainchild of sociology instructor Anthony Justin Barnum. Last week, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio, along with Michelle Cooper from the Pat Walker Health Center and Adrian Smith from the Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education, to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Barnum began the conversation by discussing his desire for creating a mentoring program.
When I first came here a year ago, I was kind of looking for where was the LGBT community on campus, because at my last job, there had been a pretty visible, pretty vocal one, both among faculty and among students. And when I came here last year, there was nothing on campus except the student organization Pride, and there was nothing for faculty. So I kind of started a faculty group first, and then wasn't really, I guess, completely fulfilled with that. We do great stuff, you know, we create community and social events for ourselves, but I wanted to kind of bridge that and take it to the students as well. And so through interacting with different people, I found out from one of my students that Michelle actually ran an LGBTQ support group out of the Pat Walker Health Center. And so I was asking the student of mine, who was, you know, kind of the connection between the two of us, kind of what it was about, and asked if they would be interested in having mentors. And the student took it back to you guys, to the group, and was, I think, it was positively received, and so we started talking and recruiting faculty and students, and we practiced it last year, and then this is our second, I guess, real year, because last year we just ran a pilot program. So basically, I was just looking for a way to kind of build community where there really wasn't any.
So tell me a little bit more about the support group.
So the support group has been around, this is its third year consistently going through counseling and psychological services. And, yeah, it is basically a drop-in group for any student on campus. They don't have to be a client of ours. And they just kind of come in and talk about what's going on that week. And sometimes it's really benign stuff, and sometimes it's really heavy, deep stuff. But it's kind of a safe place for them to come, build community, have conversations with people that kind of get what they're going through. And they do a lot of stuff together outside of the group as well. So I think they get together once a week and on their own and do all kinds of things that don't involve me. Yeah. So.
And you mentioned a registered student organization, Pride. And mm-hmm. What do they do? I guess they just kind of hang out. It's less serious.
Yeah. I mean, I think Pride does a variety of things. They meet on Fridays and they do events on campus. So National Coming Out Day is October 11th, and they're going to be doing an event on the Union Mall for that. And then they will also be doing an evening event on October 13th. And then they'll do other things. They do Pride Prom in the spring, and they will have speakers come in. They do educational things, and sometimes they just hang out together. But it's a really neat organization on campus.
So the mentoring program is just kind of another layer to add to the services that are already out there versus maybe substituting or taking over those in place of?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what, you know, we have found is that there are certain things in certain places, but there's nothing that is tying everything together. And so we are hoping, you know, one of the goals with a mentoring program is that we start to kind of tie all of these things together and get to coordinate with everyone and really let people know that there is a presence on campus and there is a place for LGBTQ plus students, faculty, and staff. And nobody has to be quiet about it or hide or be afraid.
And what is the plus? I'm not sure I've heard that used.
There are a lot of letters that go into this, but we're, you know, intersex, asexual. So we want to make sure that we're inclusive, but the when you add all the letters, it can get really long. So okay. We just put a plus.
So Adrian, how did you get involved with this project?
So for me, the direct correlation with the center as it relates to supporting LGBTQ. AI is kind of the new alphabet soup, for a lack of a better phrase of that. So it's continuing to change as we continue to try to become more inclusive in terms of the language, in terms of how we represent, and to ensure that we're capturing as much and all who should be welcome to this community. So what I work with Pride, as Michelle talked about, the center works very, very closely with the National Coming Out Day, the Pride Prom, also from Safe Zone, Allyship Training, are just a few ways in which we directly work with the community. But definitely as it relates to my role within the Center of Mentorship, part of that process, really providing training, understanding what it means to be a mentor, how do you engage in those mentoring conversations, understanding the difference between mentoring and coaching, much different how to build those relationships, but also make those productive on both sides. And so there's a direct line to the center in terms of the work that we are working across campus with the community. So it was a natural fit, but definitely something that we as a center are always trying to ensure that everybody feels welcomed, but also as we look to build an inclusive community.
So you had a pilot program last school year. What did you learn from that?
So I think the biggest takeaway for me, and I think each of us, it may be personal, I think it just highlighted the need. Mm-hmm. You know, it was something that the students welcomed, but also something that the faculty and staff members as well. And so as we think about a sense of belonging, which is both place plus space, and so one, helping both faculty and staff and students realize that they have a place to be who they are in the fullness of who they are, but also providing space for that to happen in that community building. So it was well received on both sides of that and was like, wow, this is maybe highlighting a much needed need. Again, as we start to kind of coalesce around a coalition of individuals, programs, and services to support the community. And so for me, that was the biggest takeaway was we've hit onto something. I mean, we really have an opportunity to really address a major need across campus.
How many participants did you have?
During the pilot?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we had, well, we wanted to keep it at 10 and 10. So, okay. But I think we ended up having about maybe three or four students that were really actively engaged as mentees. And then we had, I think we had 10 mentors.
We did have 10.
So it was a really good response.
Okay. And so this time for the fall, now how many applicants did you have?
Oh, my goodness.
More?
a lot more. Currently, I think we have about 35 or 36 students.
Okay.
And we have about 40, maybe 44 mentors, mm-hmm. right around there. So, yeah, I think we were hoping for maybe 15 and 15-ish, and it is huge. So we're really excited.
How are you envisioning the program working out? Meeting once a month or more than once a month? Big events, small events? How do you sort of see this playing out?
So I think we, you know, one thing that we also learned in doing the pilot was that while the one-to-one mentorship was really important, people really liked when we got together as a group as well, which we kind of had just thrown in there more as a function of evaluating how we were doing as a program. So we will be doing monthly gatherings as a group. Next month, we're having a panel on being LGBTQ in the workplace, and that's sitting on that panel are people who work at the university, but also community members that are in businesses and corporations around Northwest Arkansas. And so we're going to be doing those on a monthly basis. And then really the mentoring piece, that one-on-one relationship, you know, we hope that people meet once, at least once a month, but we're really want to leave that up to them to find out what works for them and what's going to be best for their relationship.
If I'm a faculty member, staff member who's interested in becoming a mentor, do I need to be LGBT?
Yes.
And
yes.
Why is that so important?
I don't know if I have a reason for why it's so important. I think one of the things that I guess one of the big takeaways for me from going from last year to this year is just the large amount of interest both from faculty who identify as LGBTQ and also students who want faculty mentors who are LGBTQ. And one of the things we've found in kind of matching students with mentors is that students really want someone who's like them, but like 20 years down the road. They want to know, like, how is it that I'm going to be able to navigate all of these pieces of my identity and actually come out on the other side looking successful and put together in a way? And so that's probably one of our biggest requests, I would say, in terms of what students are requesting is I want someone that has the same issues I'm going through, but who's already been through them.
As a student, I'm wondering, would it be possible for someone who's maybe not out to a lot of people to participate and have that mentor, just kind of have that one-on-one relationship, maybe not come to the big events because that's a way for them to work through that? Because, I mean, in college anyways, I think people are working through a lot of finding their identity, and that's definitely a big part of it. And maybe if they're not ready to be out to the world, they might find it comforting that there's someone who they could just talk to one-on-one. Is that a possibility? Is that something someone's maybe talked to you about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we do ask that the faculty and staff are out. But with students, I think currently we have varying degrees. And really within the group, you know, there is kind of explicit and implicit understanding that while it's a large group gathering, that it's confidential in some ways, you know, and that you need to be aware of how people want to be addressed when they're seen on campus or, you know, if where they are and if they want to be, you know, we don't want anybody to be outed, basically. And so we are really respectful of that. And the monthly meetings are optional. If people want to come and do the community building, they can. If they want to test out the waters with the one-to-one relationship and then go there, we just want to meet them where they're at and provide something that they may need. So if that's what they need, then absolutely.
Now, have any of you had maybe a positive experience with being mentored or being a mentor yourself?
I want to say that all of us, whether we realize it or not, have had positive experiences
sure.
being mentored. But most of those, at least in my case, have never been official. Like, I've never been officially mentored, for example. Like, I never had to go to a monthly mentor meeting or anything
sure.
like that. But I think, you know, there's certain people in our lives that we look up to and respect that kind of took the time to acknowledge us, to see where we were at and kind of what we were needing at that certain time and kind of held our hands a little while as we figured ourselves out.
Well, why is that an important relationship to have?
So for me, the reason why I am, one, in education, two, in student affairs is because of the mentors that I had in college. Those particular individuals who took time to not only invest in me, but to show me the way, both from a challenge and support aspect of that. Oftentimes they saw things that I didn't see, mostly from a potential perspective. Again, that place piece that you can be successful, you should be successful, and how can I support and assist you in being successful? And so for me, it's a way of both giving back and paying forward as it relates to me being a mentor on campus. It's something that I take a lot of pride in. It's something that I'll forever do as long as there's an opportunity for me to give and to pour into someone.
I also think in terms of this mentoring relationship, in terms of the importance, one thing that kind of catches me by surprise is just as students are sometimes struggling with identities that they're testing out or taking on for the first time or engaging with, they don't always realize that they can have more than one identity or aspects of different identities. And so one of the things that's been, I guess, most surprising to me is that I've encountered students through this that think that because they are now becoming this or accepting this or identifying as this, that they have to leave these other identities behind. And so, you know, I have had students that say, you know, I was, you know, raised with a certain branch of Christianity, and now I have to let that go. And I'm like, whoa, 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 you can be Christian and you can still be gay. You can be, you know, all of these different things. Being one thing doesn't mean you have to exclude all of these other things. And I think that's something that a lot of students do struggle with.
So if anybody wants to become involved with the program, do they need to wait till next semester, or who should they contact? How should they get involved?
Well, no, they don't have to wait until next semester. Okay. We are accepting applications on an ongoing basis. So they can email me, Michelle, at michelec@uark.edu, or Justin at jbarnum, so jbarnum, at uark.edu, and we'll send applications to them. It's just a quick online application, and then we usually get in contact and get the ball rolling. We have mentors waiting, so we're excited.
Well, thank all of you for coming in, and best of luck with the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Anthony Justin Barnum, Michelle Cooper, and Adrian Smith speaking about an LGBTQ plus mentoring program on the University of Arkansas campus with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. They came to the Carver Center for Public Radio last week.
The new film, The Meyerowitz Stories, is a very contemporary comedy about three adult siblings who share a father but are from two different marriages. It stars Dustin Hoffman, Adam Sandler, and Ben Stiller. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's writer and director, Noah Baumbach, who also made Frances Ha, Greenberg, and The Squid and the Whale. Join us.
At 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. every weekday on 91.3. Ozarks at Large moves next door now to the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio. Timothy Dennis is with me. Time to talk what we can listen to this weekend.
There's plenty to listen to this weekend, Kyle. Starting tonight, if you're looking for something to do and don't mind a little bit of a drive, Moon Hooch is playing in Springfield.
Moon Hooch,
they're a three-piece band with two saxes and drums. They blew my mind several years ago when they played NPR's Tiny Desk Concert. And one of the sax players, he played with a road cone in the bell of his sax to give it a huge sound.
All right.
That is at the Outland Ballroom in Springfield. The show begins at 8 p.m. and tickets are $15. On Friday, Justin Peter Kinkle-Schuster returns to Stage 18.
I like him.
He's doing an All Songs Considered tour, meaning that if you buy a ticket for the show, you can request any song of his, whether it's his solo or Water Liars stuff, and he'll try to fit it into the set.
You wanna find me? You'll find me gone.
That's fun.
It's really fun. Tickets are $10, and Thunder Comfort, who's also known as Zach Holland of the Good Fear, he's also on the bill. Show begins at 9 p.m. That's at Stage 18 in Fayetteville. This weekend, there are a couple of festivals going on in the listening area. The Eureka Springs Bluegrass Festival takes place Friday and Saturday in Basin Spring Park. Music is from 2 to 7 p.m. Friday and includes sets from Cedar Hill, the Shook Twins, and the Black Lilies. Saturday music is from 1 to 7 p.m. and includes all of Friday's performers with the addition of the band Lonesome Road.
I like the Shook Twins.
Shook Twins are amazing.
There's a motel burning. There's fire in the eyes of the musician. In the road. Turning like the world is spinning.
All that music is in Basin Spring Park in Eureka Springs, and admission is free.
Okay. Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty amazing. There's another Eureka Springs show Saturday you should be aware of. Buffalo Gals will be at Brews. They were here in the studio last week. It's Melissa Carper and Rebecca Paddock performing old-time country-styled songs. That show's from 7 to 10 p.m. Also worth noting, the other band that Melissa and Rebecca are a part of, Sad Daddy, is performing tomorrow evening from 6 to 7:30 on the main stage of the Hillbury Festival.
Cool.
More about Hillbury in a couple minutes. Finally, on Sunday, if you're looking for some music after the festivals are done, there will be an indie rock show at Backspace Sunday night. Universe Contest from Lincoln, Nebraska will perform. And then locals Lex Treefrog and Eraserfield are also on the bill.
All right.
The show is from 9 to 11 p.m. at Backspace here in Fayetteville.
Hillbury?
Hillbury. So as we said a few minutes ago, Hillbury starts tomorrow at the farm in Eureka Springs. Tomorrow night, a special jam session will feature several roots and bluegrass musicians from throughout Northwest Arkansas.
A super group.
Super group.
A supergrass group.
I mean,
group.
We're talking about more than a dozen musicians on stage. Yesterday, some of those musicians stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to give us a little bit of preview about what is being called the Shindig Music Hillbury Harvest Orchestra Jam.
I like it.
It's a mouthful, but it's really cool. Those musicians included Tom Anderson, Alan Swearingen, Opal Agafia, Michael Scambry, Chris Crovella, Patty Steele, and John Henry Holthus. That was Tom Anderson, Opal Agafia, Michael Scambry, Alan Swearingen, Chris Crovella, Patty Steele, and John Henry Holthus performing Leroy's Dust Bowl Blues inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. They'll be part of the Shindig Music Hillbury Harvest Orchestra Jam tomorrow night at the Hillbury Festival in Eureka Springs. We'll hear more from the group in a few minutes, but also yesterday morning, I spoke with Crystal Kirkendall and Robert Locke of shindigmusic.net, which helped organize the special jam session. I asked them how the idea for the Harvest Orchestra Jam came about.
At Homegrown Festival, Shindig Music had a sort of unofficial jam every night.
Yeah, it was basically just like, you know, the old midnight ramble. We just invited, you know, the squashers and said, tell everybody else to come to our tent at midnight and let's see what happens. And it turned into like a 12-hour jam every night. So
it was amazing. And Kim Smates is one of our team members, and she organized the whole thing, and it was just fabulous. And everyone talked about it so much and loved it. And there was a lot of interplay between the musicians and just amazing talent all in one place. And it was palpable magic. And I wanted to do something like that for Hillbury, which in my opinion is one of the best bluegrass and jamgrass lineups in the country. I'm a big festival fan and a huge bluegrass fan, and this definitely is the best lineup for the money. And so I wanted the Shindig Music to be involved in some way and do something a little different and bring together all the great musicians that we have up here in the Ozarks. And so I'm really excited about it. It came together a lot more easily than I thought, and I guess it helped having the Homegrown Cooler Talk jam sessions. I guess everybody was talking about that, and so I pitched it to everybody, and they loved the idea. And Michael Scambry from Red Oak Rose and Opal Agafi and the Sweet Nothings, he's formerly from Mountain Sprout, he and Alan Swearingen of Foley's Van are gonna head it up and sort of be the orchestra conductors, if you will. And we just sat down and put together a list of a bunch of musicians on different instruments that we like and respect and know that, you know, they can hang with anything.
That was Crystal Kirkendall and Robert Locke of shindigmusic.net, which is organizing the Shindig Music Hillbury Harvest Orchestra Jam. While several of the musicians involved were in the studio yesterday, I asked them why they agreed to perform during a jam session with more than a dozen musicians, where anything can happen.
For me, it was a lot of things. Yeah, I knew it was going to be a blast. I knew with the musicians in this region, I could easily put something together that would be awesome. But also, it's just an opportunity. You know, musicians are always looking for opportunities to stay relevant and keep your name out there. And this is a big festival, and we know that we're going to be playing in front of a lot of people on Thursday night. So, yeah, it's just anytime you have the chance to get exposure, I think, is something to take advantage of for sure.
And also to get exposure in a way that brings everybody together and see what the local talent, because there's a lot of national acts on the bill, and it's a really good night to like spotlight local thriving artists in our area, and it's really good.
And give some of
and
us
it's
chance
fun.
For these jammers.
Yeah, not to mention I get way better every time I do a jam or do something that's involved with this, where I get to hear everybody who brings a different song to the table. I go home with so much more knowledge and just learning.
I'm here because Michael asked me.
That's good enough reason.
I think this area actually has a lot of I don't know how to say it, you know, unexploited talent, really. This is almost the next Nashville, really. I mean, we've got Henry moved here from Kansas. I'm from Fort Smith originally, and I know Chris is as well.
I'm from Missouri.
Yeah, Patty's from Missouri.
Missouri.
Yeah, and
I'm Arkansan.
Tom?
From Iowa born.
Yeah.
So Iowa.
I know we have a lot of people moving here as well to just, like, get in on the scene. It's really a growing effort with everyone.
That was Tom Anderson, Alan Swearingen, Opal Agafia, Michael Scambry, Chris Crovella, Patty Steele, and John Henry Holthus talking with me yesterday inside the Firman Garner Performance Studio about the Hillbury Harvest Orchestra Jam Session that will take place tomorrow night at the Hillbury Festival on the farm near Eureka Springs. While they were in the studio, they performed several songs, including the classic Walkin' the Dog.
She can't, so walk in the dog. Just walk in the dog. If you don't know how you do it, I'll show you how to walk a dog. Come on now. Mm-hmm. elephant can jump that fence. Jump so high, touch the sky. Never came back to the 4th of July. Walk in the door. Just walk in the door. If you don't know how you do it, I'll show you how to walk a dog.
Patty Steele, Chris Crovella, Alan Swearingen, John Henry Holtus, and Tom Anderson performing yesterday inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. They'll perform tomorrow evening as part of the Hillberry Harvest Orchestra Jam that takes place during the Hillberry Music Festival. You can find out more about the festival at hillberryfestival.com, and you can find out more about the Shindig Music Hillberry Harvest Orchestra Jam at shindigmusic.net.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support provided by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. American humorist, comedian, author, and radio contributor David Sedaris returns to Walton Arts Center on Tuesday, October 24th at 7 p.m. Sedaris will read selections from new and unpublished works with his signature deadpan prose. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Green Forest. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for spending part of the middle of the week with us. Another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7. You can always find past editions of our program at KUAF.com and OzarksAtLarge.com, and make us fit your schedule. You can subscribe to us for free as a podcast through absolutely free services like iTunes and Stitcher. We're also available, including past editions of the show, online at the absolutely free KUAF app. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.